Welcome to News at 11. I'm Wayne McInhopple. Our top story. Police are still investigating the mysterious death of a 49-year-old man in the Lower East Side. Witnesses say he was walking to a liquor store to purchase a cheap bottle of tequila when he was accosted by three gentlemen. An amateur podcaster was there, and we have exclusive audio of what transpired.
Not tonight, my man!
Police say that there was no motive to the crime, but witnesses say that the victim was unbearably obnoxious and the host of another podcast pertaining to literary and cultural matters. We turned down to the author Richard Price to get his thoughts on this unspeakable tragedy.
I'm here with Richard Price, the author of several novels, many screenplays, and most recently, Lush Life. Richard, how are you doing this today?
Very good, thanks.
Good. My first question to you is, you've set this novel in the Lower East Side, and you were recently quoted in the Daily News as saying that that was your favorite city neighborhood. So I just wanted to get a sense of why that's your favorite neighborhood and why you decided to set this book in the Lower East Side.
Well, it's kind of my favorite because it's sort of my ancestral home. It's a complete chaos of cultures right now. What gets the most attention is the sort of boho influx, but in fact there are at least six different cultures down there. They're the immigrant Chinese, they're the housing project, an unrehabbed tenement, black and Hispanic, they're old hippies, they're the La Bohemers, they're the Orthodox Jews. It's like Byzantium. And it's also got a million ghosts.
In what way?
Well, historically, everybody staggered off the boat at Ellis Island and landed on the Lower East Side and then instantly proceeded to try to figure out how to get out. So if you see a tenement building on Orchard Street that is now a tenement museum, which is ironic since the tenements on either side of it probably could be museums too if somebody used a vacuum cleaner, they did research on this one building on Orchard Street, and they found something like 6,000 people had lived in its 10 apartments from 1866 to 1935 when it was sealed.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's also interesting because you have the tenement museum, and yet practically next door you have Il Laboratorio del Gelato. So, I mean, talk about clashing the old world and the new world right there.
Well, that's the other thing, is that right now there's a five-generation full circle back to the Lower East Side. At my age, my grandparents and their generation were probably the last people alive that, people my age could have talked to about what it was like down there. My kids that know that neighborhood so well, but basically what they know is the way it is now, the Knitting Factory or, Pink Pony or something like that. They only have a marginal awareness that 100 yards, from where they're listening to, the Uptown Horns or Harlem Shakers or whatever, their great-grandfather was in a kill-or-be-killed situation every day.
Yeah, I mean, you bring that up really early on in the book when you have Eric talk about how he's essentially haunted, and even later on that you have him star in sort of a downtown production of The Dybbuk. I mean, again, it's just, clashing what's going on with Eric as a sort of boho, struggling actor, and yet here he is sort of coming against this sort of old world.
Well, you don't need an archaeologist to see the layers of history there. All you got to do is look up. I mean, on eye level, there might be a yoga mat store or a Tibetan hat boutique. And then you look up a little bit and you've got these pitted limestone mermaid heads that were carved by immigrants. And, in 1900, nobody even knows how to do that kind of work anymore. And I always tell my kids, and I always feel like myself, If you want to really see a neighborhood, you got to look up. You got to look past the storefronts and see. I mean, basically, all you have down there is reincarnations now.
And yet, if you look up, Lower East Side 2008 as compared to even the Lower East Side you're talking about in the book, which is a few years ago. Even then, there's still tremendous surface change going on.
Well, I mean, you know, real estate is violence. I mean, if you think about it, right? The pattern, you know, right now the whole thing is to build high rises, not restore, you know, charming tenements, you know, with history. It's get rid of that thing and max out the space going vertical. So you walk down there now and it's half excavation pit. It's so hot it's radioactive. I mean, the pattern, as always, is, you know, the artists or the outriders are looking for a place to live that's cheap. They don't really care that much about how dangerous it is, but they need the elbow room to paint or whatever, you know. And all of a sudden, there's a grocery store to cater to them, and then there's a bar. And pretty soon, there's more artists. And all of a sudden, some real estate guy comes down there and goes, hey, now, you know. And 5 years later, these pioneers that have sort of like piqued the real estate guy's interest have been chased out by the new prices. And wherever they go, the real estate guys go, hey, where are you guys going? You know, oh, Bushwick, that's interesting. Never thought about Bushwick. Fort Greene, huh? You know, and so that's always been the eternal pattern, you know. See where the Bohemians set up for cheap. And in about 10 years, you know, all the executives will be living down there. And everybody will be going towards Iowa or something to find painting space.
So by this point, it's almost like your old neighborhood in the Bronx is, you know, just as up for gentrification as any.
Well, not my old neighborhood in the Bronx. I mean, the Bronx is still, you know, a little amorphous. I mean, people don't really think about the Bronx all that much when they think. I mean, although the parts of the South Bronx, they there are buildings, you know, big warehouse buildings that look kind of like the Puck Building. And so they're trying a little bit.
There's stuff going on in Parkchester.
I don't know. That's, yeah, include me out. You know, but, I mean, you know, after the Lower East Side, it was Williamsburg. Williamsburg is too expensive, and it was Red Hook, and Red Hook's going to go, you know.
Yeah, so what are you going to do? But to get back to what you're saying before about how real estate is violence, I mean, this book comes out as New York City is having its lowest crime rate in 40-something years. And even though, again, it's not set in 2007, it's set in 2003, there's clearly a trend of, you know, the lowering of the crime rate and, at least on the surface, there's less violence going on.
Well, basically the book is about a homicide, and the irony is that it's about a homicide in probably a precinct that has gone from the highest crime rates to now the lowest, where the biggest crime is purse snatching in a Keith McNally owned restaurant. But every once in a while, because you have all these six different worlds occupying the same physical space down there, I mean, everybody sort of looks through each other. It's not like they don't acknowledge each other consciously. They just don't see each other, except for 3-4 in the morning, a couple of kids from the projects, you know, well, let's go inland, flash a gun, scare some yuppie, you know, get money for Chinese food. And what happens is then this person from Indiana is for the first time looking at this person from the Smith houses, who for the first time is looking at a person from Indiana, and there's a gun, and there's a response to the gun, and the response to the gun is informed by bar hopping and movies, and everything goes to hell, and you have 5 days of headlines. It's, you know, the tabloids, you know, favorite kind of homicide when worlds collide. You know, but on day six, everybody goes back, you know, to the world that they always knew and goes back to ignoring and not acknowledging each other.
So it's sort of back to surfaces kind of going at cross purposes.
Right. You know.
Sounds paleontologic, like tectonic forces or something.
Well, yeah, except you know, there's not a hostility down there. It's not a town gown thing or something. It's just people just don't acknowledge each other. They don't see each other. They don't. It's not like they even dislike each other. They don't see each other.
Yeah, I mean,
unless something happens.
Right. I mean, it's not like say, someone who's upper middle class living in a nice neighborhood is going to go all the way down to FDR Drive and see where the projects are, unless there's a good reason for them to be there.
And vice versa. And the Chinese, especially the Fujianese, which are probably the second biggest population down here, they're invisible because, I mean, they want to be invisible pretty much. They don't want to deal with the cops. They don't want to deal with anybody else. It's, you know, a lot of them are illegal. A lot of them are in overcrowded, illegal housing situations. Get over here by Snakehead. You got to pay, you know, you may be keeping a dime for every dollar that you're making. Everything else gets kicked back to your family or to the smuggler who got you over here. And, you know, they're living like the Jews did in 1900. I mean, but nobody knows about that. Now, I've been in a building. We had heard of a Chinese suicide, and I was on the 7th precinct, and I went with these detectives. They had to interview the roommates of this apparent suicide, and there were two buildings on Orchard Street with identical facades, both built around 1890, and they went into the wrong building, and one building had been rehabbed, and it was floor-throughs, and it were, you know, seven-figure lofts, you know, kind of, you know, beautiful, not enormous, because it was Orchard Street, but, you know, you had, like, two people living there. And they said, whoops, well, wrong building. And then they went into the identical building next floor, and you walk into an apartment where you have 30 guys, 30 Fujianese guys living in an apartment with particle board dividers, you know, giant pyramid of shoes by the front door. The front door is never locked because there's too many guys coming and going. And these buildings are cheek and jowl with identical facades, and that's the Lower East Side.
So how aware were you of all these, you know, different worlds and what existed in your mind and what didn't before you started writing Lush Life?
Well, I didn't know what I didn't know until I realized I didn't know it. I had to spend some time down there to, you know, I tend to hang out.
Well, okay, what did you know then?
What I knew about is, you know, the yuppie influx or whatever passes for yuppie now. And I knew, you know, that there was some housing project stuff. There was probably some Orthodox Jews floating around. But the news was, you know, was the real estate boom and the rehabbing. But I didn't understand. The news was the rebirth. But when you get down there, it's a mess. There's more afterbirth than rebirth. I mean, it is chaos. I mean, I don't know what's more multiple of schizophrenic, you know, quadrophrenic or something, or, you know, octophrenic.
To go back to something else you had alluded to, which was that you went around with cops. I know that in a recent interview you did that when you were researching clockers, one of the reasons you went over to New Jersey is because you couldn't get access to the NYPD. So how did you get access this time around?
I just lucked out. I was having a hard time. If you go through channels, forget it. You're not even going to get permission to hang out with a meaner maid. One of my friends is Michael Daly from the Daily News, and I think he made a call for me, and that started the ball rolling, and I got permission to go and speak to the commander of the 7th Precinct on Pitt Street, and luckily for me, the guy had read some of my stuff and seen some of my stuff, and he just looked at me and he said, "What do you want?" And, of course, it was paralyzing. Nobody's ever said, "What do you want?" And I couldn't think of one thing I wanted. But, you know, when you go down there, you don't even know what you don't know. You don't even know what the questions are. I don't, you know, I never go anywhere, you know, like, I want to find out about this, this, and this. I want to, you know, I have to know things exist before I realize I don't know anything about them.
So you try really hard not to have preconceived notions. Do you take a notebook with you, or it's just really all in your head?
I mean, I take a notebook with me, but it's like, you know, somebody would wear a cross. You know, it's more like a, you know, like a good luck thing. I mean, my notes, I never look at my notes, you know, but I like to see them like a visual aid piled up, you know, but I never consult them, you know. You don't know what's important when it's happening. You just have faith in the osmosis. And when the time comes and you're creating stuff, things will pop up, you know, that you hadn't thought of for 6 months. But it's not journalism. you know, and it's pure fiction, and it's all made up. I just wanted to know what are the parameters of plausibility, because I want to lie responsibly.
You want to make sure you have your verisimilitude on tap, in other words.
Yeah, and I mean, I have OCD when it comes to my fiction. You know, I want somebody who does the job I'm describing, be it a restaurant manager or a detective or somebody who's running a housing project, if they're looking at what I did or reading what I did, that they don't walk out and discuss saying, this guy didn't get it.
And yet, how concerned are you with getting, you know, if you happen to sort of get stuff wrong?
It's all fiction, you know. The illusion is there's a right, you know, there's a getting right. I mean, it's all chaos. It's the only thing that I feel like I owe to, you know, whatever quote unquote reality out there is to be true to the spirit of it. I mean, you know, when I write and, you know, I have these kids talking in the projects, everybody thinks, you know, I'm hearing dead on all these expressions. I make half that stuff up. I mean, you know, I'm not Margaret Mead. I just, you know, I mean, you know, if I understand the mind think that goes into certain phraseology, I'll just wing it. I'll just make up my own. Nobody will know.
Well, that sort of goes into what I wanted to ask about next, which is I'm kind of going from the beginning to the end. But at the end of Lush Life, you have Eric sort of in this facsimile of New York. And it's almost as if the facsimile created elsewhere has more truth or more resemblance to what we see on the surface as opposed to what's really going on. And I guess that sort of struck me as, you know, very interesting that you had to kind of get him out of there and put him in this sort of like, you know, artificial Vegas-like New York there.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the point is that you know, you manufacture desire. Real estate can manufacture desire. They can manufacture this is the place to be. And a lot of it is stage dressing. And frankly, you know, if people have this hankering for the cutting edge, the minute you know about it, it's not cutting edge. I mean, the whole point of it being cutting edge is you don't know about it, you know, whoever you might be. I mean, it was like in Berlin. I was with my kid, and I'd never been in Berlin before. And it's, oh, got to go to this hot new club. Well, if I'm going, it's officially now, as of tonight, not a hot new club.
Is that just a function of age or just a function of you knowing about it?
It's a function of, like, I don't know what it is, but, I mean, I feel like, you know, you go to see a restaurant. Like, I hung out in Schiller's, and I use that as a centerpiece of the book a lot. And you go in there, and it's so evocative of, I don't know if you've ever been in there.
Not in Schiller's, no.
It's gorgeous. I mean, but it's got pressed tin ceilings and glazed white, or, you know, ecru glazed tiles, and, you know, desilvered mirrors and old chicken wired windows. And it looks like it's been there for centuries. But in fact, it was a pharmacy before. And all that stuff, down to the smallest detail, was imported, you know, by the owner. He was manufacturing desire. I mean, the whole thing was a stage set. And the minute people know to go to Lower State, you know, it belongs in Atlantic City then. It's a thing, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like a playground, is it?
I mean, you know, whatever's like really real at the moment is it's like too amorphous, you know, to institutionalize or give a name. You know, it still has to be in the process of coming together.
Okay, I'm going to just switch tacks a bit, which, because another thing that I had read is that you don't like to write, or at least you do like to write, but then you also don't like to write.
I like to be finished. If I could take a pill, that would knock me out and put me in a coma for 2 years. But when I woke up, there would be a completed manuscript that I would like. I'll give you the 2 years. Yeah, I don't like writing. I mean, this is kind of like, you know, abstract, but I mean, I find writing like agony. Basically, you know, you just sit there by yourself and rearrange 26 letters of the alphabet for decades on end. I mean, you know, there's no physicality to what you're doing. There's no hand-eye coordination. There's no social
there is
element.
Hand-eye coordination now. Mm-hmm. There is hand-eye coordination if you think of it in terms
what,
of
typing?
Brain and yeah, sure.
No, I'm just saying. I mean, an artist, you know, moves around a studio, an actor, interacts with others, musicians do what they do, you know. But, I mean, there's a restlessness that makes me nuts. And I think that's why I spend so much time hanging out, way more time than I probably need to, because I'm avoiding, okay, what do I do with all this stuff? And now I've got to sort of shape it into some kind of allegory of, you know, the big picture.
Now, it's not like you have a ratio of hanging out and essentially acting like a sponge versus shutting yourself away and writing.
Well, you know, it's a gradual thing. I mean, at some point, midway through hanging out, I find myself sort of sneaking something on paper. And then, you know, there's a shift. I spend more time writing, a little less time hanging out. But I never completely commit to writing, and I never stop hanging out. It just sort of happens sort of despite me.
But to go back and to another thing that I had read, you know, this is your favorite city, but part of it is that there's just so much going on. So is it that there's so much going on that's affecting your ability to write that you have to sort of go out to Long Island to get most of your work done? Or
no, I go out to Long Island, you know, basically so I can watch whatever I want on TV. Yeah, I mean, I go out there. There's no distraction. There's nothing to do out there, especially in the winter. I mean, you're on a mission when you go. I used to go to Yaddo, like Artist Colony in the 70s, you know, and what I liked about that was there's only one reason you're packing your bag and you're going up to Saratoga. You're supposed to be writing. And, you know, then, you know, when you have a family, that becomes too expensive in terms of your life commitment. But, you know, I'll take 3-4 day hits going out to, like, Long Island by myself. Because, I mean, people might have said this, I mean, writers might be the only people when they're just doing nothing and staring out a window, they're working. And when you're out there, there's nothing to distract you. So even when you're walking around, making coffee, going to the bathroom, buying a newspaper, you're working. You're in a 24-hour dialogue with yourself.
Even if you don't want to be.
Yeah, even if you don't want to be, but I kind of want to be because things... I can't force things, but, you know, if I dwell, you know, in that world, things will pop up in a way that they might not closer to home because there's too much stuff coming at me.
So it sounds as if that Long Island isn't of interest to you as a potential subject for book.
Not yet. No, I'm you know, listen, I think I always say, it's one thing I always say, which is that, you know, you can live in many places in this life, but you're always only from one place. And if you're a writer, and many writers tend to gravitate back and back and back to that one place. And for me, it's not necessarily the Bronx per se, but it is like this urban working class, you know, racially mixed life. And the older I get, the less I feel like I want to fight it. I mean, you got to write about what you want to write about. You can't write to respond to something, to show people how versatile you are or something. You go back and you go back, and every time you go back, perhaps it's a little more nuanced than it was before. Perhaps it's a different facet. But character, place is always the character. And I really like to be on intimate terms with that one character because the other characters are too big a pain in the ass, you know?
So it's like the older you get, the more that you're sort of... It's almost like you continue to sort of take whatever elements you had, say, early on, be it from your early books or just whatever life you've lived. And as you get further and further away in your own life, it's like, are you clinging to what you...
No, I'm not clinging to anything. What it is, I'm not fighting it. You know, when I was younger, I kind of felt like, oh, no, now I got to write about something else. It's like too much. And then I realized, you know, you write, I mean, I think Woody Allen said this about that Sunni or something, you know, the heart wants what it wants, you know. But it's like the thing that's going to ring your bell and make you want to write is the thing that's going to ring your bell and make you want to write. You can't force it. You just got to listen to it. And the older I get, the less, you know, I fight that gut, that homing instinct. This is where I want to write. This is what I want to write about. I'm not going to write exactly the same thing, that's for sure. But this is the world in which I feel comfortable. I mean, if you take urban America, like working class urban America, that's an ocean. I mean, you can go back to that and it would take a million lifetimes and you'll never empty out that ocean. You know, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, Faulkner never left that county pretty much.
And yet it seems as if, at least on the contemporary mainstream literature side, most people don't even get close to mining that ocean. They're going for...
Well, I mean, whatever people are interested in, they're interested. I think what happened to me is that at one point I shifted from writing about that and sort of placing myself in that world because I knew about that and I felt all I could write about was the things I personally experienced. You know, and then at some point I realized that, you know, you can just go out there and learn, you know, and then apply, you know, whatever talent and empathy you have.
So it's as if, like, you can't be, not necessarily ashamed, but the upward mobility isn't bad.
Listen, you know, am I supposed to still be living in a housing project? I mean, you know, it's like I write what I write and what happens, happens. You know, I don't feel bad about doing well.
Understandable. Well, sort of related to that, I understand that your most recent screenwriting project is to adapt an upcoming debut novel called Child 44.
Right.
And because that's been in the trades and all that. So how did you get approached for this project? And, you know, what was it even a matter of the material attracting you? Or?
Well, what happened, it was offered to me by my agent at CAA who set me up to talk to Ridley Scott. And Ridley Scott had been apparently wanting to work with me for a long time. And the reason why, I mean, it is sort of like a Martin Cruz Smith type Russian thriller. And it just, you know, of a particular year, like 53, the year that Stalin died. And it just seemed like so not me that I figured, why not? You know, let's see what happens. It's hard work, I mean, because I just wanted to do something different.
So how much, like, it's a, you know, 450-page book, and there's tremendous scope going on in a lot of different strands. Yeah. So how much, I mean, obviously you have to do some distilling, but how much, I guess, work was it in terms of taking whatever the necessary elements were and turning
I'll tell you when I'm done. But, I mean, you listen, the first job is, you know, a book is not a screenplay. And if you try to make your screenplay too true to the book, it's a disaster, because what works in literature is a nightmare on screen and vice versa. So you got to look at everything that happens in the book, and you got to, first of all, the thing you have to do is compress. You know, books are chess, screenplays are speed chess. And the first thing you got to do is you got to debride, you got to strip away, endlessly strip away this, strip what can we live without? What can we live without? And then you have to look at it and you say, well, now that I stripped all this away, I've got to put stuff in there that didn't exist to strengthen, in shorthand, connections between what remains. You know, but, and it's a thriller, so it's very complicated. You know, how faithful are you going to be, you know, to like every in and out of the thriller? I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's never used to be hard. Now it's harder now because, I mean, the older I get, the more impatient I get with screenplays in general, because the idea that I'm going to do something and it might or might not ever see the light of day, the older you get, the more, you know, crazy making it is.
Presumably you had to put this on hold for the strike.
Yeah, yeah. But now I'm back. But now I'm also got a book out. So, like, I'm like in the 10th house of madness. But, you know, so like I'm half pitching Lush Life and half, you know, thinking about the life of a KGB agent circa 1953.
Seems like you were in this position last time, too. When you were touring for Samaritan, you had mentioned in another interview that you were late on another screenplay, I guess.
Well, everybody's late on a screenplay. Nobody delivers it on time. Everybody's late for everything. Nobody ever hands in anything on time. And when they do, it's probably because it's superficial. They didn't do a good job. It's like, you know, I mean, you can't. You know, you look at something and you go, well, you know, this is gonna, you know, it's like construction work. You know, it's like, you know, a guy looks at your kitchen and you go, this will be 2 weeks. 3 months later, I don't know, the stuff from Italy didn't come. I don't know what to tell you, lady. You know, I mean, you know, building a story or adapting a book or a screenplay. I mean, you know, you don't know what you're up against until you get in the middle of it. you know, from the outside, anticipating how it's going to go is nice. But there's that old saying, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
Yeah, isn't that true? I also remember from other, talking about Samaritan and other books of yours, that the editing process with your editor was really involved. Now, you switched to a new publishing house for this book, and it seems like you've switched publishing houses with almost every recent book.
Yeah, the last, well, I was with John Sterling for Clockers and Freedomland, and then he became a publisher, not editor. So he was, you know, he wasn't editing anymore. So then I went over to Knopf, and I work with Robin Desser, and now I'm with this guy, Lauren Stein, who's at Farrow Straus. And Lauren's the first editor I think I've ever had that was not born when I published my first book.
Was that strange or just?
It was real strange, but he was brilliant. I mean, he's very, he's really good. I mean, I gave him a manuscript that was perhaps double that.
So and, like almost like 800, 900 pages, in other words.
Yeah, maybe about 800 pages. And he really helped me find the book in the book. I mean, it's like my book calved. You know, my book had a baby or, you know, I mean, it's, I mean, the stuff I took out is like a book, but, you know, he helped me find, you know, he was very good. He had the, you know, when you work on a book for so long, you know, your nose is pressed too close to the canvas. You have no idea what's striking and what's here we go again, you know, 'cause you're just so deeply invested. You know, in everything you write. And you really need somebody with a fresh eye.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's also changed since Samaritan came out is just, you know, the sheer, be it promotion or just, you know, what's going on online. And I think of this because I know that your wife has a website, your two kids are on Facebook, and yet you're the only one of your family doesn't have any real concerted web presence. Is that deliberate or?
Well, listen, I want to tell you, I really did figure out how a fax machine worked last week. So I'm coming on strong. You know, the irony is, I'm the last. It took me about 3 years to switch to CDs from tapes. You know, it's just, you know, or like the last person to get TiVo.
So you don't have an HD DVD instead of Blu-ray.
What the hell's a Blueberry? Is that like a BlackBerry or?
Blu-ray is the.
Oh, Blu-ray. Yeah. I once bought a Blu-ray thing. I didn't know what it was, and it was a mistake. You never heard of it, and I couldn't play it. But you know, I'm it's not like I'm a Luddite or anything. But I did. I always hand wrote everything in my whole life. This is the first book I wrote on a computer, and the bad part of it is because I have ADD when I write. And it's just too easy to fool around on a computer. Like, well, maybe this should go over here. Maybe that should go over. Maybe this, Helvetica or New Times Roman, you know. And next thing you know, you spend 3 hours doing nothing. And you think you were working because you were busy, but tap, tap, tap. And when you work in handwriting, it's just too labor intensive to go back. And so in a way, so I was always forced to go forward. I think in the end, it probably evened out. I probably took as long on a computer as they took when I was handwriting. But I think I wasted a lot of time on a computer because it was too easy.
You got caught up in the bells and whistles almost.
Yeah, yeah. Or, well, maybe this thing should go here, here, and here. Well, here I'll put it in italics, and then I'll use the same thing, and maybe I'll make a little, like, thing. You know, it was just doodling, you know, electronic doodling.
I know, I'm just having this bizarre mental image of you just electronically doodling and the like. I do have one last question, and that's just because I don't think it's really been brought up anywhere. And this is just, you know, me being a bit of a geek, but how did you get involved in writing the dialogue for Michael Jackson's music video?
Oh, my God. I guess
you do know it is on YouTube.
I guess it's too late to deny it. listen, it sounded like a great idea. Martin Scorsese came to me and said, Quincy Jones came to him on behalf of Michael Jackson to say he wants to do a music video. This is like when music videos were just becoming like big, like a big thing. And he wanted to show people that he's down. So he went to Scorsese. Scorsese went to me. And if you said, okay, Richard Price, Martin Scorsese, Michael Jackson, who the hell's going to say no? Of course I'm going to do it. you know, and the script that I wrote, you know, I mean, and everybody did their job. I mean, Michael Jackson actually was not a bad actor, and Scorsese's great. And I wrote a really good 8-page script. The problem being is Michael Jackson's Michael Jackson, and you look at him and it's like Minnie Mouse, you know, getting down. And then you forget the whole thing's got to end in a song, you know. So it didn't, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. But I mean, it's not like anybody was bad at what they did. It just somehow...
Well, having seen it, I mean, it works until it goes from black and white to color. And then it's just like, what?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have no interest in music. You know, I don't even like Singing in the Rain. I mean, it seemed like a great idea. Everybody came to work. Everybody brought stuff to the table, you know, and it's one of those things, you know. At this point, I think it's cool I did it, you know. Nobody holds it against me any more than they hold it against any of the other participants, except maybe Michael Jackson. But hey, you know.
It's definitely one of the more unusual writing credits.
True dat.
And on that note, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome.